This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins.
And that I will discharge the duties of my office
as mayor of the city of Charlotte, North Carolina.
As mayor of the city of Charlotte, North Carolina.
To the best of my knowledge and ability.
To the best of my knowledge and ability.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Charlotte's new mayor and city council were sworn in last night. Vi Lyles takes over as mayor from fellow Democrat Jennifer Roberts.
I want to be known as a mayor who restored faith between our neighborhoods and City Hall. I want to be known as being a mayor who can find a restaurant on Beatty's Ford Road. I want to be known as a mayor who helped create innovative solutions to actually have new apartments built for people that can afford to live in them, that the rents can be affordable. We can address affordable housing. I want to be known as a mayor who helped create jobs and a diverse economy so people can work every day.
Meanwhile, City Council experienced an abundance of change, both in the numbers of new members and in their age. Six council members, a majority of them, are now under 40.
It is our time to be warrior advocates for our people of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County, and we have to figure out how to do this together. Individual fingers can cause painful scratches and poke some eyes, but if we come together as a fist, we can break through these walls of inequity, and we can make this the Charlotte, the North Carolina, and the nation that we want to be. Thank you. Thank you so much for choosing me.
That's newly minted City Councilman Braxton Winston. Last week, we spoke with him and two more of the six young members of council about what they see as their priorities and how they plan to approach the work on council. Today, this hour, we hear from three of the people re-elected to council, members who are over 40. How might they approach this generational divide? We talk about that and more with Julie Iseult, who was first elected in 2015 and is returning for her second term. She was elected both this time and 2 years ago to be mayor pro tem. She turned that job down the first time around, citing a lack of experience on council, but she's made no secret that she wanted it this time around, and last night she got it. Congratulations. Welcome.
Thank you, Mike.
James Smudgy Mitchell is starting his second term as an at-large council member. He served as a District 2 representative from 1999 to 2013. Good morning to you.
Good morning, sir.
Both are Democrats on a Democrat-majority council. Ed Driggs, however, is a Republican and is starting his third term as District 7's representative, and he joins us as well. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
Nice to have you here. Get a little closer to that microphone. It's your only friend in the room, Ed.
All right.
Except for me, of course.
No, he has other friends.
So this time around, you've chosen to accept the accolade or the title of Mayor Pro Tem, Julie Iseult. Why?
Because I felt like I was ready to. The first time around, I was really focused on learning how to be a council member and what that meant, and learning how the city works, meeting staff, understanding who does what. And this time, I've spent 2 years doing that full time, and I felt that I was ready to do it.
There was some talk before all this happened last night that there was going to be a little battle going on for that role. That didn't pan out. Was that all worked out in advance?
The council tries really hard to work things out in advance so that we can come to the dais and do the best thing for Charlotte.
Okay, that was pretty quick and short. So what message, if any, did voters send in this last election when they elected all of these young people to council? And most of the voters who voted in the election were over 40, and they chose to go under 40 for a lot of these members. Was that because that was who was available to them to vote for, or did they actually say, we need some fresh blood on the council?
Well, I think each race is different. So when I think about District 2, I think about Justin was a community leader. He worked on my campaign in 2015. And so I do think he brought that unique approach that he has kind of paid his dues in the community. And he has a very polished and articulate vision. And so I do think you have to look at each and every one of the new council members. And I think they bring a different perspective, a different voice. And I think it's a reflection of Charlotte. When you look at our demographics and see how we attracted more millennials, I think it bodes well for our community that embrace diversity, and we can use diversity as a plus.
I was going to, if you hadn't shown up this morning yet, I was going to play something you said last night at council. You said, I'm excited about the outlook for this next term. I think you guys rock. I'm assuming that you're talking to the young people on council.
I was talking to them because they're a young and very vigorous group. I think their youth reflects in part general trends of social media and things like that, which have created this kind of instant celebrity around a couple of the new ones that contributed to their election. There were also stronger candidates who happened to be younger. So to that extent, I don't think it means that no older person can win. But what I was trying to say to them was, you guys do rock. You're incredibly talented. You're very eager. And at the same time, I was trying to convey the message that they should give themselves a little time to get familiar with their surroundings and not jump to conclusions and make commitments before they really understand how it works.
In that election, we saw some long-timers fall, Patsy Kinsey being one of them. She was on council for a long time. She was appointed mayor, interim mayor for a while, and yet she lost to Larkin Eggleston.
In
that district, do you feel like, do any of you feel like an endangered species?
Well, being the longest serving one. I do think when you look at Charlotte, how Charlotte has changed. And once again, I think we should embrace, go back to 1999 when I first got elected. I was 37 years old. And I came with a lot of energy, a lot of passion. So I see a young Jane Smudgy Mitchell in the six that are joining us. And I remember having just that fresh look, the way to look at things. And I give credit to that council at the time. They kind of embrace a lot of the new ideas and the new energy. And I think we welcome that as well.
Although, Julie, I think you and others have cautioned folks coming onto council young and fresh and full of vim and vigor that this is a hard job. This is a full-time job.
Yeah, I mean, I think they got elected because they have something to offer, right? I have also said to them, don't put yourselves in a box by being millennials or whatever label people want to attach to you. You got elected because you have something to offer. I ran for the first time in my 50s, and so it's not necessarily an age thing. I think that this younger generation, and I have three kids that are millennials, the world expects a lot of them, and they're constantly in the spotlight with Instagram and Snapchat and social media. And so I think it's an incredible amount of pressure, actually, to be that age.
Well, they're calling themselves the freshman class. They're not calling themselves millennials.
Actually, I gave him another name. I just take that back. The city manager gave him another name. He gave him the Fab Five. So those of us who understand basketball.
Mike, another thing is they are regarded as a group right now, they're not going to act as a block. Mm-mm. These are very individual people, right, and little differences have already started to surface. So I expect this coming term to be pretty turbulent, but at the same time, a time of change. Good for us.
Well, I spoke with three of the six under 40 last week on this program, and those three cited, independently of each other, economic mobility as their top priority. And we all know that in Charlotte, that's a key issue because of a study that revealed that if you're born poor in Charlotte,
right,
chances are you're going to die poor here if you don't move away.
Right.
And the mayor cited yesterday on this program affordable housing. In that clip that I played from her speech last night, she talked about affordable housing. What's your leading issue, the three of you? Julie, I'll start with you. What's your leading issue? What do you think is the most pressing thing we need to work on?
Workforce development for young people.
Okay.
Workforce development in general, but we have got to include young people in that category.
Ed.
We have a community safety problem that is actually national. It's occurring in other cities as well as here, but it has to be a top priority of ours to guarantee the safety of our citizens.
Smudgy. Can I call you Smudgy or should I call you James?
Yeah, Smudgy.
Okay.
Creating jobs and continue to recruit those corporations that allow opportunities for our citizens.
So is creating jobs and workforce development, are those the keys to economic upward mobility?
Well, you know, my personal story, I could tell you, I was born in Southside. Back then in 1962, Southside was considered a project, and my father worked two jobs so we could move to Batesford Road in a middle-class neighborhood. And so I am a fan that if it wasn't for my dad getting a second job cleaning up buildings, I never would have got out of poverty. So I'm a big fan of how jobs can create and allow you to have a nice, decent home as well as skills. So I'm a big advocate that jobs can solve some of our problems in our community.
And when you say workforce development, what are you talking about, Julie?
Individuals that have high barriers to employment, so that is connected to public safety. You know, if you have someone that's gotten out of prison, they've spent 20 years in prison, they don't have any skill sets, what do we think that they're going to do? They don't have a lot of options, and many of them return to the streets without other options. Young people who get out of high school and they don't have employable skills.
I want to explore that with you and others around this table when we come back from the break, and also what can City Council really do about these issues when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we are talking here with three long time in that they're not under 40, city council members. Last week we talked to three of the six under 40 council members. You can hear that conversation along with our conversation from yesterday with both Mayor Jennifer Roberts and new Mayor Vi Lyles on our website at WFAE.org. Those other three, the millennials, were Braxton Winston, Tariq Scott-Bakari, and Dimple Ajmera. You can hear that conversation on WFAE.org. This morning we have Julie Eiselte, our new Mayor Pro Tem, James Smudgy Mitchell, who represents he's an at-large Democrat. Also Ed Driggs, Republican, who represents District 7. We talked about jobs, creating jobs. The mayor, Mayor Roberts, was on this program yesterday. She touted her record of the number of jobs created while she was mayor. Mayor-elect Vi Lyles talked about her desire to create jobs. Julie Eiselte and Smudgy Mitchell, you talked about workforce development and job creation. Is that something city council can do, that a mayor can do?
We do it. Go ahead, James.
How?
Yeah.
Well, I will say, and I give Mayor Lyles credit. 2 weeks ago, we had a discussion about economic development and where we're going, and she challenged me to reach out and identify the top 10 companies we need to relocate to Charlotte to really pursue. And so I do think she has the right vision of us being very active, having a strategy and making sure we go out to the right companies.
So does City Council do that? Does Charlotte Center City Partners do that? Does the Charlotte Chamber do that? Does the Charlotte, what's the one that Ronnie Bryant's in charge of?
Charlotte Regional Partnership.
Right. Yeah. Who does that? Can't all be doing it. It would be a nightmare for companies.
Well, but I think, Mike, we each play our role, so we do it as a team.
Okay.
We collaborate, but I do think the mayor making a call to Amazon to say we welcome you to come to our city, and then have a Bob Morgan to do the legwork, and for Ronnie Brian to say, I could bring some talent to recruit. And so I do think the mayor is going to be very focused on what companies do we need to relocate. And we got to have a great balance. We got to have the white-collar jobs, and we got to have the blue-collar jobs as well. So you would see that as a top priority for her and for the Economic Development
Mike,
Committee.
Mike, there is a limited capacity that the city has. We've invested in a program called PEACE, which is a partnership with two local nonprofits to try to create a total environment of service to certain people who have barriers to employment. That can serve a few hundred people. But at the same time, the critical thing for job creation on a macro scale is to maintain a business-friendly environment. So one of my priorities on council has been not to let things happen that are hostile to business. When you look at some of our development policies, for example, or our ordinances and things like that, we have to keep in mind that if this is a business-friendly place, companies will come here and they will hire people.
That's right.
One of the things that newcomer to council Tariq Bakari stressed last week when he was on this program, Ed, and he's talked about this elsewhere too, is the idea of simplifying the development process, lowering the cost for developers and ultimately the costs for renters and home buyers. There is a perception, however, in Charlotte that developers always get their way, that if you're going up against the developer, you might as well just fold your tent and go away because it ain't going to happen. They're going to get what they want. How much easier do we have to make it? Just look around us. I mean, things are going up helter-skelter here.
At first, I think that there's a misconception about that, because when a project comes through the development process and the rezoning process, if it gets into several months into it and there's significant opposition on the parts of neighborhoods and it's a well-organized neighborhood, mm-hmm. the developers know if it doesn't get through the neighborhood, it might not get through the council, so they're going to pull it. So everything that does come for a decision before council, by and large, the developer has an idea that it will pass, that it's been vetted. Now, the neighbors don't always agree with it, but they doesn't also mean that they have been involved from the get-go. So a lot of work gets done. A lot of projects get pulled that aren't going to pass.
But given how much development is going on here, which is an indication, at least to me, a layperson, that people want to develop projects
That's true.
Here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How easy do we have to be? Why can't we play a little hardball here and say...
The issue is not even whether it's easy. The issue is there are many obstacles to development in the form of inspections, onerous processes you have to go through in order to reach completion on a project. So a study was done by the Gartner Group a couple of years ago. Only a couple of years ago, it cost $300,000, and it found that the whole experience of trying to build here and develop here was actually worse than in many of our competitor cities. So it isn't even a question of being permissive.
But does that matter, given the fact, I keep saying look around, but look around.
Yeah, but Mike, to A's point, development is not bad. I mean, you want to be a part of a city.
I'm not saying that it is. I'm just saying how much easier does it have to be? And when you say easier, when Tariq says easier, and you say we have to be friendlier toward development, exactly do you mean?
What I mean is that we maintain the advantages that we have by not going into a situation that is really inimical to development. So we have many things going for us that mm-hmm. caused them to come here. They've caused them to deal with some of the barriers they've encountered. We want to encourage that because with that development, in that growth, comes job creation, which is one of our key priorities.
And to tie the two together, Ed mentioned a peace program, and one of the training components is residential and commercial construction because we see the boom. And so if you see a crane, we think we should be able to train our citizens. And so they do work hand in hand. Where there's growth and development, we think it's an opportunity for our citizens to gain skills.
Julie.
And to that point, that's the other part of workforce development. There are hundreds of jobs in the city that can't be filled because people don't have the right skill sets. So it is about preparing these folks. That's one of the biggest complaints we hear from developers and builders is that there aren't enough people in the city that are qualified for these
and
jobs.
And where and how do you do that? Where and how do you qualify people for these jobs? How do you train them?
Well that's the Peace Program.
That's the Peace Program. Right now we have a partnership with Goodwill and with the Urban League, and we're training them in three major components, Mike. Residential and commercial, HVAC, and fiber optic. We see those are the three industries right now that are looking to have a shortage in skill set. And so we take them through a 14-month period. And so far to date, we've graduated 118, and 97 have permanent jobs in our city.
Doesn't CPCC have similar programs? Are we duplicating the effort, reinventing the wheel, or is this something that they don't do?
No,
because the Peace Program has a bunch of components that address the specific challenges of people who have been in an adverse environment, who have barriers to employment.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
CPCC, and I wanted to mention this, performs a critical role in the overall job creation through its training, vocational training, mm-hmm. and letting people acquire the skills. But Peace is about addressing specifically those barriers that somebody, say, who's been incarcerated or has other obstacles to employment in order to help them get to work.
How long has this program been?
It was part of our community letter. We kicked it off.
Actually, it existed before the community letter. We increased our investment in it after the community letter. I'm on the
community letter came last year.
Last September. It had been in place before that.
The community letter was in response to the unrest that happened.
What we did then is we accelerated our goal for affordable housing, the timetable for the 5,000 units, and we also increased our investment in Peace on the kind of jobs priority that we identified.
So do you have a track record? If you're training people who are hard to hire because A, they don't have skills, but B, they've been incarcerated and therefore they have a record and people may be reluctant to hire people with a record, are you having success with getting them hired?
We are, as I mentioned earlier, 118, 97 have full-time job employment, and they would not have that opportunity if it wasn't for the Peace Program. So we have a track record. I think the challenge for us going forward, Mike, is not use this as a pilot program. It needs to become a permanent program. Mm-hmm. And so we have a corporate advisor. We have a luncheon coming up December 13th. And so we have the corporate community who've bought into it. And so The challenge for us is finding the funding to continue the successful program in our community.
Brent emails, the rewrite of Charlotte's zoning code is way behind schedule, and the planning director's job has gone unfilled for more than 2 years. I was going to talk about this. I'm glad he brought it up. Meanwhile, poorly conceived projects are going on critical tracks along light rail lines, and sprawl continues unabated. What will this council do to get these processes on track and assure that Charlotte's rapid growth is also sustainable? Mm-hmm. Who would like to take that?
I think the planning director position will be filled soon.
Mm-hmm. What's taken so long?
It has been difficult. It has been difficult because of, I think, the perception of candidates of the prospect for that job here, some of the challenges they thought they might encounter. This manager, I think, has done a good job of recruiting. So we are expecting success there. And as far as the unchecked development is concerned, we have an ongoing process, which is called the Uniform Development Ordinance, that is in the works, but it's a huge, ambitious undertaking, and it's going to take some time.
Who's responsible for hiring the planning director?
City manager.
City manager. And we've had a changeover in city managers from Ron Carley to
Marcus Jones.
Marcus Jones, a man I do not know because he won't come on the program. You can work on that.
We'll work on it.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, Ed, the plan. What's it called?
UDO.
It's referred to, yeah.
Unified Development Plan. They've been working on the Unified Plan for a while now without a planning director.
Correct.
Is that wise?
That is actually an issue.
It's a big issue.
Because the planning director needs to put their imprint on that. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. It is a very ambitious thing that intends to consolidate many of the ordinances we have, but also create a new concept of places, which is much more prescriptive than our current policies. It gives me some concern, frankly. But I think that's going to take a while to implement, and we need to take some steps in the meantime to update area plans and keep in step with development.
Because right now they're in the process of rewriting decades-old regulations about land use, about building design, sidewalks, trees, and more, and they expect to have this ready by, 2019, which is a year. Am I right? 2019?
Are you
that's what they
breath?
Say.
Okay. That's what they say. Thank you.
And when do we expect to have a planning director with whom we have been without? That's right.
Without whom we have been
since 2014.
Yeah.
It's English grammar time.
I think that's a near-term prospect from what I'm told. I don't know how much more we can say about that, but it feels like we're in an advanced stage.
All right. Let's get back to this influx of youth.
Yes.
On city council. Do you anticipate these younger members to take a substantially different approach or to take different positions than previous council members have? Do you expect them to want things to happen right now?
Well, that has to do with youth, and the mayor pro tem can tell you I'm impatient as well. So it has nothing to do with age. That has something to do with I think everyone is we're tired of being in the planning mode. I think we're all in the action mode, implementing mode.
And that's certainly what the mayor has said in her campaign.
That's right.
The time for talk is over.
It's over. It's
time to do.
So in my brief conversation with some of the newly elected officials, I think they're going to dive in. They are going to embrace a way to streamline and have technology more available for all citizens can participate. I think the common theme I'm hearing from them is new voices at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I think anytime you open up the tent, you bring new voices in, and I think that's a good thing.
Colette Forrest, who leads the Black Political Caucus, believes younger people, and this is a quote, tend to take risks that older generations don't, and she says they tend not to be safe in their decisions. Yet, she expresses excitement over seeing the energy that they will bring to council. Now, the three that I met last week on this program, very level-headed, but if that doesn't prove to be the case, are there safety measures in place on council so this doesn't run amok, or do you think we're going to have a rough road for about a year till they learn the ropes and until they realize that this is not an overnight process?
I did caution them last night. The biggest concern I have is they come in, they're very intense, they're full of ideas. We don't want to make promises we can't keep. We don't want to take positions that aren't supported by thorough analysis. Mm-hmm. So I welcome their energy. Mm-hmm. I think those of us who are returning will help to temper their enthusiasm. And the staff is a huge component in all of this as well. There's a lot of inertia built into city government. So I think their ability to kind of you know, upset things too much is limited.
But you don't want to tamp down that excitement.
You don't.
No.
You don't.
I mean, I've often said, even though I'm, you know, the age I am, I'm working on at this job because I want to create a city that my kids will want to move back to. So everything that we're doing, the bigger decisions we're making, are not for what's happening today. It may be today, maybe tomorrow, but it's really for 10, 20 years out. So we want to create the city that attracts people 10 to 20 years from now who want to move here.
Can you be on the same page with these guys? One of the things, they don't want to be called millennials. They want to be called the freshman class, but this is the number one destination.
Yeah.
But this is the number one destination for millennials.
Right.
And we want it to be. Mm-hmm. So that telegraphs the message, it seems to me, that, look, we value you. We have
six
of you on council.
That's right.
Here. Can you get on the same page?
I think at the end of the day, I mean, you got to get six votes. And that's one thing they would learn as you become an advocate to a policymaker. And I do think that would probably be the only learning curve they have to understand. How do you get six votes? How do you get your colleagues to understand your passion? Have you done your research? And making sure that what you're trying to implement will work for the city of Charlotte.
We have a young council. We have a majority Democratic council, Democratic Party council. Creative Loafing said in their clog not too long ago that this makes this the most progressive city council we've had in years, and we'll talk about the implications of that in light of the last 2 years when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to three of the returning city council members. Ed Driggs, a Republican representing the 7th district, not the congressional district, the 7th district.
Promotion.
In his third term. James Smudgy Mitchell, Democrat at large, formerly represented District 2, and he's in his second term at large. Julie Eisel, also in her second term at large, elected last night to be mayor pro tem. Two Democrats, a Republican. You're one of how many Republicans?
Two Republicans
on council.
Yes.
Where does that leave Republicans in Charlotte?
Well, I think particularly the outcome of this recent election leaves us wondering what our prospects are in Charlotte. Even the Observer pointed out it's unhealthy to have such an imbalance, and I don't think it's reflective, in fact, of the composition of the community. So it just means the two of us have to work harder to present the conservative point of view as well as represent our districts.
Isn't the legislature doing that for you?
The legislature is, but it puts me in an interesting position. And I've said frequently I'm a Charlottean first and a Republican second.
Okay.
But I have been at times an intermediary trying to speak Republican in Raleigh on behalf of Charlotte. There are things that happen locally over which the legislature doesn't claim any jurisdiction, and those need to be balanced in my mind.
Last 2 years have been a tough couple of years for Charlotte. And we have, as Creative Loving pointed out, with a majority Democratic council and a majority young council, probably the most progressive council on record in recent years. If we weren't progressive in the last 2 years, I'm not sure what we were, given the ordinance that city council passed that led to the legislature feeling the need to pass HB 2, which led to all the fallout we're all too familiar with. You guys were on council. Mm-hmm. Did you make a mistake?
Make a mistake in what way?
In passing that ordinance that led to HB 2. Okay.
And I warned them. I warned them in the chamber that I had heard that if this passed, it would be overturned. I did not anticipate HB 2 and everything that came with it, but we knew that we were picking a fight on Raleigh when that passed.
Okay.
Yeah. Mike, I was with the mayor pro tem. I mean, I voted for it because I thought it was the right thing to do for the citizens of Charlotte. Did I think our state legislation would get involved? No, I did not. I did think it caused some bad relationships between the city and the state that we're still trying to repair right now. I do know mayor says she's going to speak with the speaker and the Senate pro tem about how does Charlotte and Raleigh work closer together going forward.
Are you hopeful that that can be successful, those conversations?
We have to be hopeful because the General Assembly holds the power. I want to get back to a point, though, about progressive Republican. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with passing that ordinance. I think that we allow other people to define the narrative here. I believe that for the most part, Charlotte Republicans are a lot more moderate than the Republican Party is being characterized right now. And I think that Republicans can do well if they don't attach themselves to groups that come from out of town that have very strong religious bents. And that's what happened in this recent election.
We had a fairly progressive Republican mayor for 14 years.
Yeah.
We did.
Until Pat McCrory went to Raleigh, which is the face of the Republican Party, the Charlotte Pat McCrory or the Raleigh Pat McCrory?
There right now, as you've seen in Washington, there is a lot of diversity within the Republican Party that makes it difficult for them to come together on a lot of things, in fact. So I don't know there's a monolith that's the Republican Party at this point. Mm-hmm. I'm a Republican more in the Reagan style. There are certain traditional Republican values that I try to uphold. I don't associate with a lot of the nonsense that goes on. And in local government, you've got to kind of stick to basics. A lot of what we do isn't really partisan.
You got to pick up the trash and make
nuts
the water
and bolts,
run.
Right. It's transportation. Yeah. It's trash collection. So we need to be focused on the task.
You'd be hard pressed to find votes that were 9-2 on our council this past year or the past 2 years. I think we really stick to running Charlotte, the business of Charlotte. And to that point, when people say this is wildly progressive, follow the votes and see how these young people vote, see how we vote. And I think that's the bigger issue. And with regards to passing the ordinance, I still maintain that that's what Charlotte needed and wanted at the time, to be a city that is welcoming to all people. That's how we attract businesses to come to that city, this city. And the General Assembly has got to, at some point, acknowledge that urban communities, which do generate the tax that will go back and be redistributed to the rural counties, that we have to be allowed to have some flexibility to be able to attract those businesses here.
One of the great crises that this city has faced in recent memory was the unrest that followed the police shooting of Keith Lamont Scott last year. We've talked ad nauseum about this, but former Mayor Roberts was on this program 2 days ago, or yesterday, I can't remember which, and she said that the city was unprepared for the impact that social media on mobilizing those protesters.
Yep.
How would you assess the city's response, and do you think the city is now prepared for this viral mobilization that can happen with social media?
That's an event that you can't rehearse for.
That's right. Yeah.
The police did have a lot of contingency plans in place and so on. But at the end of the day, when it happens, you're kind of reacting.
Right.
And again, one of the things we didn't anticipate was a lot of the bad information that was going out on social media, which fanned the flames out of step with what had really happened and what was really going on. He had a book. He didn't have a gun. He was wearing an ankle holster, and his trouser leg was hitched up over it at the time the incident occurred. But that fueled a lot of it, and we were reeling, frankly. I think it's fair to say that we were struggling to keep up with the events.
And, Mike, you asked a question, are we prepared now? And I say the answer is no. I mean, social media has changed the way we serve, and I do think that needs to be a topic as we go into our retreat January 31st about embracing social media, but use a way to really inform our citizens.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a national issue, too. You see news outlets that are putting up tweets after the Las Vegas shootings, putting up tweets saying Hannity had on there that too bad it wasn't just Trumpsters who were shot. Well, they found out that was a troll account. And so even national news organizations, but they made that the highlight of the discussion for the whole program. And so this is an issue that every city and that the government has to face. It's a very serious issue.
Fake news.
The city is growing by leaps and bounds. Transportation and transit has got to keep pace or we're going to be gridlocked. The new council has taken over from the old, transit plan with a substantial funding gap. I think it's between $5 and $7 billion. CATS has proposed light rail now to Matthews and Ballantyne. They want to fast track that, no pun intended. I think they want to go to the airport with light rail. I think they'd like to have additional form of light of rail transportation to Huntersville and beyond. The city, of course, is dealing with building out the streetcar.
Correct.
And will be operating that separate from CATS. How important is figuring all of this out and finding the money to do it, and can the money be found to do it?
Wow. So I'm glad I'm not chairing transportation and planning, because I think it's going to be a tough issue for the city council. And Mike, you touched on it, is the funding source. I do think having a good relationship in Raleigh, as well on the federal level, allows us to move the needle a little bit. But we need a comprehensive plan and truly trying to determine how are we going to fund it, because the worst thing, and I'm going to be frank, most people don't find transportation sexy. So they find that they rather us concentrate on public safety, economic development, until they're stuck in traffic. And then the first thing they complain about is we're about to become the next Atlanta. And so I think it's one of our top priorities that we go to retreat is how do we deal with
it? I'm reading all these articles now about driverless cars. And some say that they're 10 years away. Some say they're 30 years away. But they say that when they come, they're going to rewrite the landscape for automobiles. Because if there are driverless cars, you don't have to own a car. You just Uber it yourself. You just send a car will come to you when you need it, and you'll go, and it will cut traffic by 2/3. Because driverless cars will also talk to each other, and you won't need traffic lights. They'll just do what they need to do at intersections, and the people really in danger at that point are going to be the pedestrians,
because
they're not going to be wired into the system.
That's right.
I mean, do you see this as is planning even talk at city levels,
wow,
even talking about this yet? Because we're talking about spending billions on light rail, which we may not need in a driverless car universe.
We are talking about it. It was discussed at our retreat last year. It's hard to plan for this, partly because the evolution of
right.
the driverless car is difficult to predict. And the truth is, you can create a car that can navigate it among other cars with
right.
drivers. That's one step. But the ultimate goal is to have a system, an information system on the roads and everywhere
mm-hmm.
that informs the cars. And so that eventually I think there will be no drivers. I told my kids, you'll probably remember a time when people had to steer cars and think it was quaint. But we don't know the timeline. And there are very different estimates among professionals and in the industry about it. So we have to move ahead with what we have and do things that will still be useful in that context. And I don't think that we're going to render all forms of mass transit obsolete.
Let's talk about something that is right now in front of us every day, and that is the rising murder count in Charlotte. Julie, you chair the Public Safety Committee, which oversees CMPD, or at least you did in the last council. I'm assuming that continues.
We don't know.
We don't know yet.
What do you think, and you've alluded to this in your opening remarks, Ed Driggs, that we have a public safety at the top of your list. What do you think is driving this rising number of murders in Charlotte?
So we do have a group that's working on the, not calling it a task force, but the homicide issue. And we have a group of citizens. It's very much citizen-driven, but our community relations committee is running that. Former council member Ivory and myself attend that meeting. And we decided to go out to the community. We've gotten 400 surveys back on why they think, what leads to these homicides, what can people do in the community. We're sort of distilling that information right now and trying to just really take it at a grassroots level, because it is community-based. If you look at the scattergram of murders in the city, it's not like Chicago, where it's pretty much in South Chicago. It's all over the city. And 80% of these folks knew each other. It was a dispute that happened.
Which leads to this question. If 80% of the people involved in these homicides know each other,
right.
is it really a public safety issue? Most people are safe.
It's a cultural community issue, and so we have to get to the bottom as to why guns have become the primary tool for conflict resolution in some cases.
I think it is a community safety issue, a public issue, in the sense that the perception of the community about their personal safety is affected
That's
by the
right.
headlines related to this. But I want to emphasize the fact I asked for and got from the chief some data about how we compare to other cities. We're actually doing relatively well.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of what we're experiencing here. So I think you need to look at national themes. I think you need to look at the Ferguson effect, the impact that has had on policing, and the way officers now have to consider decisions they make, which makes them, although still very dedicated, reticent at times. And I think that's bad. This concerns me particularly because people judge CMPD, or they criticize them, or they suggest that they're out to kill members, minorities. We need to support them. We can't let the narrative take hold that somehow it's a failure of CMPD or a race bias on their part that's contributing to this.
Ed Driggs, you get the last word. Republican gets the last word on council today.
Hot diggity.
Always.
He's Republican from District 7. James Smudgy Mitchell, Democrat at large, serving his second term on City Council. Julie Eiselt, her second term at large, and the new mayor pro tem. Three of the returning members of Charlotte City Council. You can hear our conversation with three of the new young members of City Council, along with our conversation with both the outgoing and the new mayor of Charlotte, Vi Lyles, on our website at WFAE.org. Thank you all.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Mike. This was great.